This show's going to be about the First World War. The oldest son of Queen Victoria was Edward VII. For 60 years, he was the Prince of Wales and heir to the British throne. After his father, Prince Albert of Saxe-Coburg-Gotha, died in 1861, his mother, Queen Victoria, went into deep mourning, and the Prince of Wales became active in the affairs of state. Edward VII married the Princess Alexandria of Denmark and took a seat in the House of Lords. Their first son, also named Edwards, was one of the main suspects as being Jack the Ripper. A prominent British doctor claimed to know the identity of the Ripper, but he died mysteriously, and his family burned all his papers. Sir Charles Warren, the chief of the London police, was the master of the new Freemasonic Lodge in London and was accused of suppressing evidence. He resigned. This particular lodge had been founded in 1884 with a warrant from the Grand Master of British Freemasonry, who was Edward VII. At the time, Germany's strongest ally was Russia. The German-Russian alliance had been made with the reinsurance treaty by Bismarck, and Edward wanted to make Russia an ally of England and France while at the same time convincing Germany that England was her great friend. Edward VII was only king from 1901 to 1910. During that time, he was successful in encircling Germany with the alliance of other countries. Edward made treaties with Russia, France, Italy, Denmark, Spain, Portugal, and Japan. Years before the war, British Foreign Secretary Sir Edward Grey negotiated a secret understanding with France and with Russia to join together in order to repel a German attack and guarantee the neutrality of Belgium. From 1887 to 1914, the European nations had been led to maintain large standing armies, universal military service, and modern weapons as the policy of the central bankers, which dictated their governmental decisions. This had been the modus operandi of the Rothschilds during the 19th century. Under the pressure of international finance, the atmosphere in Europe became very congested. Instead of using this huge money resources for cultural purposes, the international banking houses urged unlimited armaments of European states and sometimes deliberately precipitated military adventures. By 1900, these European countries could not afford a war. At the beginning of the 20th century, Great Britain was out to control as much of the world's resources as it could. A new and very valuable resource was, of course, oil. At this time, thanks to Cecil Rhodes, Britain had control of most of the gold and diamonds of Africa, and oil was necessary for exercising World War I as well as the other horrors that followed. Large deposits of oil had been discovered in the Middle East. Germany was also looking at the wealth buried there. But unlike Great Britain, Germany did not have a large, capable navy. So she started building a railway from Baghdad to Berlin that could give Germany direct access to the Persian Gulf and the Middle East oil fields. Great Britain viewed this railway as a direct threat to the British Empire's strength. Since 1887, the bankers had been waiting for the United States to enact a central bank plan so that they could finance a European war among the nations who they already had bankrupted with armament and defense programs. Until 1898, the United States didn't own a bit of territory outside the mainland of North America. At that time, our national debt was a little more than $1 billion. Then we became internationally minded. We forgot or shunted aside the advice of the father of our country, George Washington. We forgot Washington's warning about entangling alliances. At the conclusion of the Spanish-American War, we took over Puerto Rico, Cuba, and the Philippines. From 1900 to 1902, there was an insurrection in the Philippines. Many of the rebels were of the Muslim faith. They believed that they would not be able to enter heaven if they ever touched any part of a pig. After one battle, the American army had 600 Muslim prisoners. They wrapped them all in the hides of dead pigs and then machine-gunned them. In 1911, the slums of Dublin, Ireland had a higher death rate than the slums of Calcutta. Woodrow Wilson was elected to the presidency in 1912 and took office in 1913. Wilson was the first president in 113 years to address a joint session of Congress. Clerks had previously read the messages. Had not Theodore Roosevelt formed the Bull Moose Party, President Taft probably would have been re-elected President of the United States. Woodrow Wilson would have returned to obscurity. There would have been no Federal Reserve System, and World War I would probably have been avoided. Germany at the time of Napoleon consisted of 300 little separate political entities, and between the period of Napoleon and Bismarck, those 300 separate units were consolidated into one state. Within 50 years after that time, Germany became one of the world's great powers. Their navy was rivaling Great Britain's. They were doing business all over the world. They could make better products and undersell them to anybody. In 1914, Germany was only 40 years old. Wilhelm II was the Kaiser of Germany. He was the grandson of Wilhelm I and also grandson of Queen Victoria of England. His mother was Princess Victoria, daughter of Queen Victoria. I guess we have all heard the term kissing cousins. George V of England and Nicholas II of Russia were his killing cousins because they were also his enemies and his cousins during World War I. That same year, 1914, Great Britain and Russia controlled one half of the earth. Britain ruled 13 million square miles and 444 million people, yet only a small minority of the British subjects could vote. 98% of the wealth of Great Britain was controlled by 2.5% of the population. Only 15 men owned 50% of the land of England. In 1911, Germany, England, and France had a treaty that allowed individual Germans to do business in Morocco. Then England and France signed a secret treaty to drive Germany out. For this, France was to abandon claims to commercial rights in Egypt, and because of this, Europe almost went to war. English journalist William T. Stead called this underhanded diplomacy an almost incredible crime against treaty faith. Years before this, the British Foreign Secretary, Sir Edward Grey, negotiated a secret understanding with France and with Russia to join together in order to repel a German attack and guarantee the neutrality of Belgium. This understanding was unknown to the British cabinet and the British Parliament. The Archduke Franz Ferdinand and his wife Sophia were heirs to the Austro-Hungarian Empire. They were shot by a Serbian nationalist. Using this as an excuse, the Austrian army attacked Serbia. Russia defended her Slav cousins and attacked Germany and Austria from the east. At the same time, the French attacked Germany from the west. The German army advanced through Belgium and Luxembourg, wanting to outflank the French forts and armies along the Franco-German border and capture Paris and end the war on the Western Front in a month. They may have succeeded had the army not advanced faster than their allies could keep up. England gave Germany until August 4, 1914 to withdraw from Belgium. At the same time, the English ship Talconia was headed to Emden. Beneath the ship's keel was a network of five cables that went south from Germany through the English Channel. One went to France, another went to Spain, one went to North Africa, and two went to the United States. The Talconia had huge grappling hooks which were used to pull these cables from the bottom of the ocean in order to make repairs as needed. This time, the hooks were used to pull the cables aboard and cut them apart and then drop them back into the sea. After that, Germany could communicate with the Western Hemisphere only through a subsidiary cable that ran from Liberia to Brazil. This line was mostly owned by the United States. A few months later, this cable was also cut by one of Talconia's sister ships. From that time on, Berlin could only communicate through Marconi's newly invented and pretty unreliable wireless. As one New York Times reporter noted, all word of happenings in Germany must pass through hostile countries, Russia on the east, France on the west, and England on the north. The war was only 2 days old when the French government wanted to borrow $100 million from J.P. Morgan's Paris branch. Morgan was afraid the United States government would object. They did. Secretary of State William Jennings Bryan said that money is the worst of all contrabands because it commands everything else. Powerful financial interests have the ability to influence many other parts of society, especially the press and politicians. Propaganda was everywhere. People who were against the war were called pro-Vandal, pro-Goth, and pro-German, as well as anti-American and unpatriotic. At an anti-war rally, one young man called Americans a lot of skunks. He got 6 months in jail. A Los Angeles Times assured its readers that no plans were made to send any of our armies overseas. When Britain entered the war, she set up a blockade of Germany so that not even any food from other nations could enter. It is a fact that two-thirds of Germany's food supply had to be imported, and it could only be imported through the proceeds of what Germany exported. So if Germany could not export, two-thirds of Germany's population would have to starve. There just was not enough food for more than one-third of the population. The United States was a neutral country. Why not be neutral? The American people had no conceivable political or economic quarrel with Germany. Almost half of our citizens were of German descent, and by a narrow margin, German had been voted down as our country's national language. As a neutral country, there was no reason why we could not ship food to Germany. We didn't because of the British blockade. England would not allow any foodstuffs into Germany. We respected England's blockade against Germany, but we ignored the German blockade against Great Britain. Our Secretary of State, William Jennings Bryan, found this reprehensible. Food, he said, is not contraband. The British blockade would finally kill over 800,000 Germans, and of course, the casualties were heaviest among the children. French Prime Minister Clemenceau said that there are 20 million Germans too many. Hoover supervised and organized food relief efforts in the countries abroad during the First World War. Hoover even wrote of Germany's anguish through this relief mission. He described malnourished children with large, dull eyes, large, rickety foreheads, small arms, just skin and bones, small, spindly legs with dislocated joints, and swollen stomachs of the hunger edema. Churchill wanted to let the Belgians starve and blame it on Germany. He questioned Hoover's ancestry and denounced Hoover as a son of a female dog, but he did not use that exact term. Churchill denounced Hoover because Hoover had reported the German crisis. On May 7, 1915, less than a year after the war erupted, a U-boat torpedoed and sank the Lusitania. It had 173 tons of war munitions on it, but the British and Americans denied it. An ad appeared in American newspapers prior to the embarkation of the Lusitania. It stated, "Travelers intending to embark on the Atlantic voyage are reminded that a state of war exists between Germany and her allies and Great Britain and her allies, that the zone of war includes the waters adjacent to the British Isles, that, in accordance with formal notice given by the Imperial German government, vessels flying the flag of Great Britain or any of her allies are liable to destruction in those waters, and that travelers sailing in the war zone on the ships of Great Britain or her allies do so at their own risk. Signed by the Imperial German Embassy, Washington, D.C., April 22, 1915. This ad was in 50 American newspapers, including those in New York. The British authorities were aware that a German submarine was in the path of the Lusitania, but failed to divert the ship to a safer route. They also failed to provide a destroyer escort, although destroyers were available in a nearby port. The ship was ordered to reduce speed in the war zone for reasons that have been kept secret ever since. How did such a big ship sink so quickly from a single torpedo strike? At this time, Parliament passed a Defense of the Realm Act. This act gave more power to British censors. They could scrutinize every word sent from England to the United States. Charles F.G. Masterman, a member of Parliament and also a reporter and author, was put in charge of propaganda. He brought in H.G. Wells, Arthur Conan Doyle, John Galsworthy, and Rudyard Kipling, along with another 48 writers. Sir Gilbert Parker, another member of Parliament who had been born in Canada, was chosen to be the propaganda master of the United States. Parker was also an author who had written about the Canadian Northwest, where he had never been, but he was a successful writer. He assembled a group of assistants. One of them was A.J. Toynbee of Oxford. He wound up with 54 people working for him by 1917. He sent weekly reports to the United States newspapers, keeping them informed on the war's success and why the United States should enter on the side of the Triple Entente. The Triple Entente consisted of the countries of England, France, and Russia. He supplied 360 papers in less populated states with London's line on the war. Much of the propaganda pertained to the necessity of keeping Little Belgium democratic and neutral. At the time, Belgium was as neutral as Scotland was neutral. It was as democratic as Prussia was democratic. Belgium's border with Germany was loaded with forts, but there were none on the French border. Belgium's King Albert I was the son of Leopold II, the monster of the Belgian Congo. King Albert I had much legislative power, unlike the executive in any other democracy. Germany was pictured as a habitual military power, yet France, which had a population smaller than that of Germany, but had an army greater than Germany's. France had a lust for military glory and conquest. They had established an empire in Indochina and Africa. Britain had the world's largest fleet and an immense empire ruled by force and not very democratic either. Britain's propaganda told of the German soldiers stabbing young children with their bayonets, raping women, and cutting off women's breasts and the hands of young boys so they could not hold a gun. Actually, cutting off the hands of people was what the Belgians did in the Belgian Congo when the natives disobeyed them. Of course, the Germans countered with stories of the Belgians gouging out the eyes of wounded German soldiers and shooting German officers at the dinner tables of the treacherous Belgian host. Berlin permitted some American reporters to accompany the German army through Belgium. The reporter sent a telegram to the Associated Press stating the stories of German atrocities were groundless. But the British sent a group of Belgians on a tour through the United States telling stories of German atrocities. The group was solemnly received by Woodrow Wilson in the White House. The famous attorney Clarence Darrow did not believe the stories and went to Belgium to investigate. He offered $1,000 to anyone who had their hands cut off by the German soldiers. He got no takers. The $1,000 would translate into $17,000 in 2002 dollars. Viscount James Bryce was a famous historian during this period. One of his publications was sympathetic to the Gaels' hard lot under British rule. He had also collaborated with Roger Casement to expose the horrendous exploitation of indigenous people on the Amazon by the British Rubber Company. He, along with six other commissioners, analyzed 1,200 dispositions of eyewitnesses who claimed to have seen the atrocities of German behavior. They didn't interrogate any of these eyewitnesses, and because these so-called atrocities took place in a war zone, there was no on-site investigation on any report. The report was released to almost every newspaper, and the headlines were, quote, "German atrocities are proved," finds the Bryce Committee, "and young and old mutilated." The Bryce Committee also accused the Germans of using women and children in front of the army and using them as shields. When the Lusitania was sunk, William Jennings Bryan cited its manifest that listed ammunition and materials for uniforms and leather belts in its cargo. Secretary of State Bryan said to Wilson, "A ship carrying contraband should not rely on passengers to protect her from attack. It would be like putting women and children in front of an army." American reporters stationed in France at the battlefield soon learned that if their stories were going to reach the United States, they had to favor the Triple Entente. Even the reporters that covered the war from Britain had to send their reports through the Netherlands to London before being cabled to the United States. On August 2, 1916, a group of American correspondents in Berlin signed a protest complaining that their dispatches were constantly suppressed, mutilated, or delayed by the London censors. The American public, they said, were not getting the vital half of the most important events of the war. Arthur Balfour told Wilson in the privacy of the White House that Britain, France, Russia, and Italy had signed secret treaties dividing the spoils of the war between them. Russia was to get Constantinople. France was to regain the lost province of Alsace-Lorraine and a large portion of the Saar Basin, which was rich with minerals. France was also going to divide Turkey's Mediterranean Empire and Germany's African colonies with England. Japan was to get Berlin's Far East colonies, which included China's Shantung Peninsula. Italy was to get the Austrian South Tyrol and Trieste regions in the north, as well as control of the Dalmatian coast on the east side of the Adriatic Sea and some colonies in Africa. This was a long way from Wilson's vision of peace without victory. Winston Churchill encouraged the insurance companies of England to offer the ship owners of America insurance at a very low cost so they would not be adverse to sailing their ships into harm's way. He figured the more U.S. ships lost, the quicker the United States would enter the war. He also told the British ships to look at the survivors of German submarines as felons and to shoot them, which is what often happened. The U.S. passed a law in 1790s outlawing the practice of shipbuilding for any belligerent countries. During the Napoleonic War, the French government tried to outfit privateers in American ports. Fearing this would embroil the country in a war with England, Congress banned the practice. During the Civil War, the Alabama, a Confederate built in Great Britain, caused a lot of havoc to weaken the Union shipping and relations between the United States and Britain when it reached a low point. Even though Britain calls submarines an underhanded weapon, First Sea Lord John Fisher told Charles Schwab that the British government needed to acquire more submarines and fast. Schwab told Fisher he could build 10 500-ton undersea boats at crash speed. The deal was consummated with a handshake. The U.S. Navy inspectors at Bethlehem Steel told Schwab that what he was doing was illegal. So Schwab shipped the parts to Canada, where another company welded them together. Wilson still wanted the practice to be stopped, but he was ignored, and in June 1915, the 10 500-ton subs sailed out of the harbor at Quebec for the war zone. On April 6, Major Palmer S. Pierce testified that the United States was supplying Great Britain, France, and Russia with 40% of their war material in 1916. England was spending $70 million a week in the United States. In 2002 dollars, that would come to $96 million per week. On April 6, 1916, Major Palmer S. Pierce testified before the Senate Finance Committee about the Army's request for $3 billion to fight the war. When asked what the money would be used for, Pierce said, for building training camps and buy rifles, artillery, airplanes, and we may have to have an army in France. The chairman of the committee, Senator Thomas S. Marin of Virginia, exclaimed, "Good Lord, you're not going to send soldiers over there, are you?" Wilson set up a committee on public information. The committee consisted of the Secretary of State Lansing, Secretary of War Baker, and Secretary of the Navy Daniels. The chairman of this committee was George Creel, a Missouri journalist, well known for his muckraking style. He had written a book, Wilson and the Issues, in 1916. Creel held one, and only one, meeting with the other men of the committee on public information. Major Douglas MacArthur was serving as Secretary of War Baker's information officer. This was the Army's first venture into public relations. In 1916, Germany had won the war. The German submarines, which were a complete surprise to the world, had swept all the convoys from the Atlantic Ocean, and Great Britain stood there without ammunition for her soldiers. They had 1 week's food supply, and after that, starvation. The French army had mutinied. They had lost 600,000 of French youth in the defense of Verdun. The Russian army was defecting. They were picking up their toys and going home. They didn't want to play war anymore. They didn't like the Tsar, and the Italian army had collapsed. Not a shot had been fired on German soil. Not one enemy soldier had crossed the border into Germany. Yet here was Germany offering England a negotiated peace called on a status quo ante basis. This means, let's call the war off and let everything be as it was before the war started. We'll continue with World War I on our next program.